mythical Odysseys of Theranos, mystic
Iliads of Thanos.
We only got half this book. The other half was destroyed. snapped out of existence. Who knows if we got the good half?
We got the good half. Live from the Mundangerous Polis in New York City, I'm your host Shane.
And I'm your host Ishan.
And welcome to episode 255 of Total Party Thrill, a podcast for game masters and players where we discuss our campaigns in order to inspire yours.
In this episode, we're reviewing the newest release for 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons, Mythic Odysseys of Theros. We'll walk you through it digital cover to digital cover and let you know whether it's worth adding to your collection. The world is on fire both from climate change and the way it is run terribly here in the United States. But hey, if you want to read some interesting stuff, some cool stuff, Mike Pondsmith over at R. Talsorian Games has a new post up titled Cops and Racists. If you don't know him, he is one of the minds behind the classic game Cyberpunk. Cyberpunk 2077, you know, the dystopian future where you've got, you know, hackers and a state that controls everything that people does, and there's a panopticon, and, you know, he just has a few suggestions about what the police should be actually doing in terms of, like, reform and defunding. And then also he, you know, has an admonition. Remember, the cyberpunk future is a warning, not an aspiration. Whether we hear the warning is up to you. So, link in the show notes. Go ahead and check that out. It's a cool read.
Mike Pondsmith is one of the very few black game designers who has been in this industry since the 90s, right? Like, he's a long tenured member of this industry.
So, I don't know, maybe listen to him.
Yeah. He probably has some good ideas about our industry and also about being black.
Tune in tomorrow, twitch.tv/godsfall, for the actual, definite, absolutely finale of Castle Amber.
This is the real one.
It definitely is. It has to be, because I used all my spells, because I thought the last two sessions were going to be the finale, so I was just like, woo.
I hedged. I still have a couple left, but I am out of real time to spend Fridays doing this, so. Aram, our editor, is the GM for this, so Aram, get us through.
So check it out tomorrow night on the God's Fall Twitch channel. All right, here we are. The review, cover to cover, Mythic Odysseys of Theros. Why is that name? Why is the name of this book so difficult to remember and say?
Because it's nothing.
it's a claptrap of random words that have to do with myths and gods and stories.
It's Greek, right? It's just Greek. I don't think you can hear that title and wonder that it's not based on Greek. But this is the 5th campaign setting book from Wizards of the Coast for 5th edition. Follows up Sword Coast Adventurer's Guide, the Guildmaster's Guide to Ravnica, Eberron Rising from the Last War, and the Explorer's Guide to Wildemount. This is the second of our settings that are based on Magic the Gathering crossovers. This is from the set that was released in 2013. And as mentioned, it takes its inspiration pretty much entirely from ancient Greece.
Would we say inspiration, or would we say steals wholesale and just changes proper nouns?
It does a lot of that. It posits a world in which ancient Greece is the whole world.
An eensy-weensy world.
Very small world. It really does file off a lot of serial numbers from Greece, and, you know, surrounds it with cool art. Because it's magic.
Mostly for magic cards, right? If you took a Latin class in high school, or you're just into, you know, cool mythology, then you basically already know most of the lore in this book. But, you know, we'll get into it. Let's start at the beginning, the cover.
Hydras.
Both covers are cool. Two covers, right? So there's a cover from Jason Rainville that shows some heroes fighting a Hydra. It's a pretty dope Hydra in the middle of a city, which is obviously where you want to have most of your battles, your big set pieces. But the alternate cover, I really like the alternate cover.
Yeah, so the alternate cover is following the same style of, like, kind of having like a foil sort of feeling to it, right? Like those Hydra 74 covers for the earlier books had, where it's meant to have a different look and feel. This one is actually more focused on the gods looking down on a hero battling a Hydra, and sort of like within, it's the perspective, I think, of Nyx, which is the realm of the gods in the sky. It's cool. It's really cool. It's definitely a departure from the other alternate covers that were created by Hydra 74, though. Like, the thing it shares is it will have the foil.
Right. So it won't necessarily match on a bookshelf, but so this is art by Kevin Tong, and it feels so like fourth world Jack Kirby to me. I love it. Like, it is bright, and like, it's like a kaleidoscope of colors.
Let's talk about this bookshelf for a hot second, because if you want to add it to your bookshelf, you cannot do that right now. We're not reviewing yet. This book in exclusively digital form because it was released on D&D Beyond last week and will not be released in physical form until July.
And, you know, we're talking about the covers, but you got to dig deep into D&D Beyond even just to find the covers. So you're not really going to be able to enjoy it for another month.
Yeah, like this is weird, right? Like,
yeah,
from the company that wouldn't do any digital support for a long time to now like releasing first on digital and then releasing it in physical is like a pretty big departure.
I do wonder if it's going to eat into their book sales, because you're going to have a lot of people who, you know, are sort of chomping at the bit for this and want it a month earlier, and they'll just buy it on D&D Beyond and then probably not buy it hardcover.
So they've done the same thing, right, where they have the game store exclusive, the shiny cover is the game store version, and then the kind of more classic D&D style is the mass market Barnes & Noble, Amazon thing. So they've done that to kind of help protect their local game stores. I'm guessing that what they've seen is that LGS market is pretty stable, right? You buy the collector's version because you collect the book, and you don't if you don't care. And they care less about Amazon than they do about getting this in the hands of more people. And they're putting that out at the same price as Amazon on digital, supporting their digital partner. I know we'll never see the sales. I guess if they continue to do that, you'll know that this was a big boon for their sales.
Yeah, it also could be that, you know, they don't expect everyone to rush out and buy this, right? It's not an adventure path. It's not like an IP that like everybody has been clamoring for. It's just sort of, you know, a relatively interesting new setting book that people who already love will definitely go out and get. And, you know, if you were going to be the person who's going to buy the hardcover anyway, it doesn't really matter when it comes out, you're going to get it. All right, so let's get into the actual book. First off, there's an introduction to the world, Theros, which is just ancient Greece.
This is a world in which the gods were born of belief. That's what empowers them. You know, the massive mortals have created the gods, and their belief of those gods has shaped who they are. They are now entrenched in power. You know, that belief is not so shakable, is not so fast moving, they can disappear. And
it is,
that's it.
It's the warp. we created the chaos gods into existence. It's Planescape. You know, belief becomes reality. Although, yes, like you said, not as quickly as it happens in Planescape.
There are three planes. There is, you know, Theros, the material plane, the world that we're on, Nyx, the sky realm of the gods, and then the underworld, which is, you know, Hades.
Both fate and destiny, which are real, tangible things in this world. Most people are bound by fate. They're destined. They are going to live out a relatively quiet existence. Other people are chosen by destiny and will become heroes who defy, you know, dull and boring fate.
The whole definition of a hero is one who flouts predetermination. That's what you have to do. You have to resist destiny in order to become a hero.
And then the connection of PCs and NPCs, like people in the world of Theros, to like all of this mythology and the gods, is basically like there are archetypal heroes who aren't necessarily in the way that the Greeks had named, right? Like you had, you know, Perseus and, you know, Achilles, who did deeds that were necessarily attributed to them. In Theros, you have archetypes like the slayer and the philosopher, who are usually unnamed and probably a conglomeration of different deeds done by different people in the distant past. This does a couple of things. One, it means that you can sort of place yourself into that ideal, or you can even say like my character's ancestor was the person who did this particular deed. It also means that the person who did the deed can be a woman, can be non-binary, can be not necessarily like Greek. They don't have to look like a typical Greek, right? They are an archetype, not a specific person. And then that really opens up the inclusivity of these myths.
A lot of the art is multicultured, I guess, is how you would kind of look at it. They don't look like typical Greeks exclusively, right? Like, this is a setting that has, you know, two brothers and one of them has dark skin, the other has fair skin.
Oh, interesting. I thought they were lovers.
That is the companion art. That is their, like, archetype or whatever. Their
lifelong companion.
Yeah, lifelong companion, yeah, uh-huh. is their type. So they were joint kings. They founded one of the city-states.
One of the city states. It does basically Athens, right?
It's Miletus. Miletus? Yeah, Athens.
Yeah, it seems like they basically took everyone that you could have seen in like the actual Roman Empire, not Alexander's Greek Empire, and said that all of these kinds of people could appear here in this tiny world of Theros, which I think is certainly much better than having just everybody be, you know, traditionally Greek from 400 BC.
Yeah, unless you want sort of a Japanese samurai flavor, in which case you're a lion. But yeah, I guess we'll get to that.
We will. Okay, so world history. In the long, long ago, the world was ruled by archons, who are sort of like lawful, neutral, celestial primordials.
Mm-hmm.
And then the two joint warrior kings overthrew the archons, and then thus began the Age of Heroes.
Aided by the gods that that mortals created, they founded the poleis, whatever.
Plural of polis, the poleis.
And now, like, we have epics that tell little bits of that history. Like you said, it's sort of the telling the archetypes of the heroes. So the Iliad or the Odyssey are basically there, except instead of being the story of Achilles and the story of Odysseus, they are the story of the slayer. They are the story of the philosopher.
Yeah, and they just rename them. And there's one other that are basically the tales of Hercules and his labors and ordeals, things right. Like that. Not the Aeneid.
Well.
Sorry, Latin kids.
Heracles, you know.
If you're like us, this is the part you've been waiting for. Chapter one is character creation. So first up, you get a heroic drive. It's basically an additional ideal or an ideal that can replace one of the ones you already have based on the deity that you worship. And there's really no reason not to worship a deity in Theros.
It's almost required. Like, your gameplay is, and this is something that I think is weird about how they've laid out these chapters, is like, they don't explain piety yet. They don't explain what you do yet as characters, but yet they throw these options out here and they're like, you definitely want one of these drives. We'll tell you why later. You basically have to tie yourself to a deity, or you're defining your character by explicitly not believing that deities are worth worship. That's your two options. Otherwise, you're not a champion, you're not a hero, you don't belong in Theros.
Right, and there's the one option of deities aren't worth it, and then like nine other options of like, hey, here are the different things you can do for different deities.
It also gives you legendary bonds and tragic flaws. These are basically like, take whatever you have as your bond and then make part of that a god, right? So the person you are bound to is actually your god has taken mortal form. You know, your tragic flaw is, you know, whatever your flaw was, crank to 11, right? You're not proud. You have hubris. You know, you're not lazy. That's dumb. You are rash, you know, like take the things that can be your undoing. Expect that to be your story. Choose things that the gods can wheedle and manipulate you through.
And then we come to supernatural gifts. Supernatural gifts show up in the Dungeon Master's Guide. They're like extra stuff that the GM can give out. But Theros basically assumes that your PC is a hero and begins with one of these supernatural gifts. It means that Theros PCs are just baseline more powerful than characters in other settings.
Yeah, so what's weird is it says that you can take one of these gifts, or alternatively, if you have like sort of a backstory reason, you can start with a feat. Ishan, I don't think any of these are feat quality. So if you choose that feat, you better have a real good reason for it.
Wait, you're saying these are stronger or weaker than a feat?
Oh, way stronger.
Oh yeah, totally agree. I mean, yeah, if your options for the feats are like actor and observant. I mean, lucky. I guess you could take lucky, right?
Sure, but one of these gives you an eighth level spell.
Oh, in addition, right? Not just an eighth level spell.
Right.
Right. All right, so let's go through them. There's Anvil Rot, which basically means you become a construct, or you are a construct. You were built at some point. It gives you all the great stuff where you don't have to sleep, eat, breathe.
You're immune to disease. You have advantage on saves versus being poisoned. And you can do like the power down version of sleep rather than actually sleeping. So you're not unconscious.
Right. You basically get a trance ability.
Yeah.
That's on top of whatever your race might be. Right. So you can be an Anvil Rot, whatever, elf or minotaur.
One of the cool ones that I really like, and I think is a good just default option. I think this should almost just be default for the game, is Heroic Destiny. It makes you tougher to kill, right? You have a purpose, so you are more likely to be able to complete that purpose. You get advantage on death saving throws, and when you're reduced to 0 hit points but not killed, you can instead drop to 1 hit point once per long rest. So you stay in the fight, you don't just succumb.
Yeah, again, this just stacks with other stuff, right? If you're playing a half orc or something like that, great, now you have two of them.
Yep.
Then Iconoclast is the character who rejects the gods and basically says, you know what, I am uninterested in, you know, fealty or piety or things like that. So you get some abilities where you can sort of slough off the magic of the gods. You can cast Dispel Magic, eventually Dispel Evil and Good, and then, like you mentioned, eventually you can just cast Anti-Magic Field.
Yeah, I mean, but keep in mind, because you're not getting, like, you have no purpose for faith, right? So you're not getting those benefits of faith. So this is taking your supernatural gift and your faith into one ability.
Right, you don't get the piety rewards, which we'll talk about later.
Then there's the Inscrutable, who is, like a Sphinx. You can't really be, flummoxed. You're strong of mind, so you get resistance to psychic damage. And you are immune to an effect that allows other creatures to sense your emotions or read your thoughts. You grant disadvantage on insight checks to read your thoughts.
Lifelong Companion, as we mentioned, is one of these supernatural gifts. You have another person who may be a PC, there may be another hero, maybe they're an NPC, who you're basically bonded to, either through blood or love or something like that. It gives all of your allies within 5 feet of you advantage on saving throws versus frightened, charmed. Yeah, frightened or charmed. And then you can basically take a hit for an ally who's adjacent to you.
Yeah, this one sucks.
It does. I know.
You can get Nyxborn, which is just great. You get resistance to necrotic and radiant damage because you are born of the gods. So their damage types, right, don't hurt you as much. And then you get Cloak of Stars. So as an action, once per long rest, you can just grant disadvantage on attacks against you for a minute, which makes you immune to sneak attack and all types of other things.
Oracle means you're able to tell the future, and your ability is, of course, related to the divine in some way. So your abilities are dependent upon your piety rather than your level. So at low levels, you're able to cast augury as a ritual, then divination, then commune, and you can't be surprised. And then eventually, you can increase your intelligence or wisdom score by 2, as well as the maximum, which is the equivalent of a very rare magic item.
Yeah, so that's basically you have a double piety track, which is super strong. especially if you happen to be a wisdom-based character, you could potentially have 24 wisdom.
Pious just means you have a strong connection to a particular deity. You can re-roll a saving throw once a day. You have an advantage on religion checks pertaining to your god. And you start with a piety of 3 rather than a piety of 1, which, it puts you 2 sessions ahead of everybody else sort of permanently.
Yeah, I take it back. This is actually the worst.
Really? Because the next one's Unscarred. Once per short rest you roll, you can subtract the damage you take by d12 plus your con mod. And that's it.
Okay. All right. Well, in fairness, I misread that and I thought it was just as a reaction. I didn't know that was once per short rest. That's truly bad. The Unscarred is actually an awesome idea, though, which is just like, that makes you Achilles.
Right. Right? Except, like, unfortunately, it doesn't make you Achilles.
Yeah. Except Achilles. Except it was shoot him twice was actually the problem. You right. know? It wasn't his heel. It was just twice. Double tap.
All right, let's get into the races, because there are several new races and they're swingy.
There's several reprinted races. There's 2 new races.
All right, so first up, we have the centaur. Is this exactly the same as the centaur that we had before? It's fey, it's medium size.
Yep. It is the centaur from Ravnica.
Yeah. Strength plus two, wisdom plus one. Nothing really changes here. It's pretty good. You have a charge attack, you have a hose attack, you have a higher carrying capacity, and you get some extra skills. The big thing is that you are fey, so you are untargeted or unaffected by things like hold person, dominate person, but I think it introduces some interesting effects with banishment and dispel magic and good.
Yeah, especially in a world that has none of those planes.
Right, so where do you go?
Then next up is Leonin. These are your lion folk. They live on a savanna out between the city states, and they get plus two con, plus one strength. They get a 35-foot base speed and dark vision. They get a natural claw attack, proficiency in athletics, intimidation, perception, or survival, which basically means you get a free proficiency because I think every character takes one of those, or at least every class has one of those on its skill list. And then their main ability is Daunting Roar, which is just bad. Like, it's a 10-foot radius wisdom save that scales on your constitution, and it frightens enemies or creatures of your choice until the end of your next turn. Like, it's once per short rest. It's just bad.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing it has going for it is that it's a bonus action. So if you have nothing else to do, you're like, fine, I guess I'll roar. But Leonin in general is not a good race mechanically.
I mean, because con is a bad base, right? Like, doing plus two con is like, cool, I get hit points, but like, I'm bad at the things that I should be good at. Like, no one is good at scaling con, so it's
also boring. Any of this plus strength plus con races are mostly boring because then also their flavor is almost always like proud and noble warrior.
Well,
here we are.
There's always one.
We get a Minotaur.
Yep, which is identical to Ravnica, which is not good.
And again, plus strength, plus con. And you have natural weapons because you're an animal person.
And then
intimidation or persuasion. That's basically it. The Satyr, though. Oh my God, the Satyr is amazing.
Satyr is
too,
the problem.
Too powerful.
Yeah. So it's plus charisma plus dex, which unfortunately opens it up to all of the classes that are problems. It has a 35-foot base speed. It is a fey creature type, which comes with those benefits that you mentioned. It gets a natural attack and a bonus to jump distance. It gets proficiency in performance and persuasion and an instrument. But none of that matters because all that matters here is magic resistance, a thing that you can't even get from a feat. You can get a watered-down version from a feat, but grants you advantage on saves for spells and magic effects.
This is an epic boon.
That's
the only way that you get it aside from a high-level magic item.
Yeah, and like this is the kind of thing that you throw on monsters and increase their CR by two,
right?
Like, they're just stronger. So like, cool, yeah, if you need a charisma character or a dex character, take Satyr. Keeping in mind as well, like, most of the PHB options are rather limited in Theros, right? Like, to play true to Theros, you wouldn't necessarily have all the dex-based and all the charisma-based races that are available elsewhere.
Which means, power gamers, you have an excuse to pick Satyr, because if you can, do it. And then we get the Triton, which we've seen before. Although I think there was an addition, they now have dark vision, so they can actually see at the bottom of the ocean.
Oh, I missed that. That's great. I've ignored Tritons for so long that I had forgotten they had that foolishness. I will say they got upgraded art. The Tritons in this look dope.
Oh, way better. Yeah, we only have one piece of Triton art, I think, before, and they look terrible. I can't tell if these like fin things on their head are part of their heads or they're just mask armor, but they look amazing.
Yeah, they are. They remind me more of merfolk than they do of just like blue humans.
Right.
But they're cool.
All of blue human paladins.
Yeah. All of these feed into the new subclasses, which are Bard College of Eloquence. This is, you know, every Bard College does something different with its inspiration, right? Like it gets some specialization on inspiration. The College of Eloquence is that it sticks around longer is basically its move.
Yeah. If someone uses an inspiration die and fails on the ability check or what, you know, whatever it is they're trying to affect with it, they just keep the inspiration die.
Third level, you'll get reliable talent for your persuasion or deception checks.
That's amazing. Like third level.
Yeah. You can't roll less than 10 on
persuasion or deception. I would dip for that because, I mean, you know, third level bard gets you so many other things too. But on any character that wants to lie or perform, this seems like a no-brainer to me.
Well, yeah, but then at third level as well, you also get unsettling words, which
right.
lets you use bardic inspiration to reduce the target's next saving throw by your bardic inspiration die. So, like, that's a huge debuff to target monsters with, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. Like, -8 on a saving throw? Like, cool. Fire away, you know? Granted, you got to line that up because it has to make the saving throw before the start of your next turn, but still, it's a bonus action. It's easy to use. Level 6,
right.
as you said, unfailing inspiration. If you fail a saving throw, or if you fail the check that you use a bardic inspiration on, you keep the die. So it goes further.
And then also at 6, you get a ribbon ability, universal speech, which I love. As an action, choose a bunch of creatures, and now they can understand you for an hour. That's always been my problem is like with so many performance-based abilities, it's like, oh, they have to be able to understand what language you're speaking. Well, now it means you're a better diplomat, right? Like you can talk to whomever in Atlantis or Olantin or whatever they call it here because like you speak every language or people get the words that you're saying because you are some sort of universal bard.
And then at 14th level, you get infectious inspiration. If somebody uses your bardic inspiration die and succeeds, then you can use your reaction to give bardic inspiration to another character up to charisma times per day, and it doesn't use one of your original bardic inspiration dice. So you basically get two pools of bardic inspiration. One is bardic inspiration, the other is infectious inspiration, and you get just more uses of bardic inspiration in a day. Bards don't typically have a lot of use for their reaction other than counterspell anyway, and strong but kind of lame.
Yeah, the low-level stuff makes eloquence, I think, a very good option for bards. Unfortunately, the Paladin's Oath of Glory, I wanted to really like. I love the idea of it. I don't find it good.
No. So paladins are measured by their auras, and this is going to be a problem.
Also, it's terrible that they change up the mechanics of the aura that every other paladin has.
Okay, we'll get to that.
Okay.
Starts with spells. You do get haste, protection from energy, and flame strike, which are all good and interesting things for a paladin to have.
And then you get Peerless Athlete as a bonus action for your channel divinity. You get advantage on athletics and acrobatics checks for 10 minutes, and you increase your carrying capacity, and then long and high jumps increase by 10 feet. This is nice for like our combat this time is a challenge where we're in the Olympics, and you know I'm just going to best everybody.
Yeah. But what you're really here for is Inspiring Smite. So after you deal damage with Divine Smite, you can use your Channel Divinity as a bonus action and give temp HP to creatures of your choice within 30 feet of you. The problem is that it is 2d8 plus your class level, and that scales very, very poorly as you get higher.
I mean, it is nice that you can divide it as you choose. The problem with like blanket temp HP is so often many of them are wasted because only one person got hit. But
right.
Eh. Aura of Alacrity, your 7th level aura makes everyone in your aura faster. Their speed increases by 10 feet for a turn, but this only affects allies who are adjacent to you. They've got to start their turn within 5 feet of you.
If they start next to you, they run away faster. It's the worst aura.
What is even the point of it?
Who cares that much about speed?
I mean, wizards places such a huge barrier to increasing movement speed or getting fly speeds or God, what's the other? Oh, it used to be increasing strength, right? Like a +2 strength meant you had to have like a -2 to intelligence to balance it out because strength is so powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And now everyone knows it's charisma, of course.
Right. It's dex. I don't know. At 18th level, it becomes a 10-foot aura, which still,
wow.
Like, you're a paladin. You're in the front line already. Like, how are you really helping the mobility of your group if you're in the face of the biggest monster in the fight? what you're helping other people run to other problems. Like, you should be drawing people into you, right? Into you. That's the value that you would add. So you're it's, if they can end their turn within 5 or 10 feet of you, they should get the bonus to speed. That makes sense. What are you doing?
At 18th level, your crappy aura increases to the size of every other paladin's third level aura.
Right. Yes. Which, and also,
and their auras are amazing.
And also, it does nothing for your saving throws. Like, doesn't help you against fear. Doesn't help you against spell damage. It doesn't do anything of the good ones.
That's the other issue, is like, you still get your aura protection, like, you know, increase to saving throws, but then you have a different aura that's not the same size. You have to keep track of two sized auras. It's so dumb.
Stay close, but run away. Lose my aura. What?
Which one? Which aura are you talking about?
This is such a backwards ability. So backwards. It doesn't fit the flavor of Oath of Glory. It doesn't fit the, like, value of 5th edition combat. Like, I don't know how they did this.
I don't understand it either. All right, at level 15, when a creature you can see within 10 feet of you, gets hit, you can use your reaction to give them a bonus to AC. Equal to your charisma modifier, yeah.
Yeah, so this is a shield spell you can share.
Of course, they have to be close to you, but, you know, they've run away from you because they're so fast.
Yes, again, right? Like, why that aura is backwards. This ability is great, period, because you're going to want people clustered around you. You're a paladin. That I think it's fantastic. And then the other thing is, if it misses, you get a free attack, which gives you an off turn smite, which is super powerful. So 15th level ability, spot on.
And then your 20th level capstone. It is nice that it is a bonus action. Most of these abilities are an action, which means you're wasting an entire round of double smiting. You get advantage on charisma checks. And then once on a turn, when you miss with a weapon attack, you can just hit, which is actually really great. You're not rerolling it. You're just saying, I hit.
Yep.
Which is, gives you one of those situations where, you know, you sort of like lean into your piety and say, I'm actually going to close my eyes. I want disadvantage on this because I want to miss, because otherwise I'm not sure that I can actually hit this deity.
Right.
But at 20th level, I can. And then in addition, if you fail a saving throw, you can use your reaction to reroll it.
What's cool about this, so these capstones are typically once per long rest. This one actually recharges with your 5th level spell slot. So you can just get it back if you would like to. Granted, costs you an action to turn it on, so it's tough to use on its own anyway. But, you know, it's slightly lower risk.
And then we get a single background athlete. You get acrobatics and athletics, land vehicles, which is supposed to be for chariots, which I think is a nice touch.
Mm-hmm.
And then you are basically a famous athlete when you go places. Some will recognize you and be like, hey, I remember you. I put money on you at the, you know, 100 meter, and I'm going to buy you drinks.
Yeah, so it's a settlement within 100 miles. There's a 50% chance, which I was like, that's not very far. You know, 100 miles, like, that's nothing. And then I get to the next chapter and it's like, oh, Theros is 200 miles across. And I'm like, cool, which city is in the center?
It's also weird, like 200 miles, a marathon, which originated in Greece, is 26 miles. Like,
well, you run it in a circle now, you know?
Oh, of course. It's just like one runner can run across the known world in a week and a half.
Yeah, we run ultra marathons in the real world. Like 130 something miles is like, okay, it's a few days.
But then you're like, oh, and nobody knows what's on the other side even further. And someone's like, I didn't want to run for 2 weeks.
Yeah, I do know it's one way. Like, you could just sail off the side of the map and go to Nyx, apparently. It's 200 miles away. But no one's heard your name.
All right, next chapter. It's a pretty beefy chapter because it goes through all of the gods, and of course they are extremely important here in this setting.
Yeah, so this is the player side of the gods. The next chapter will cover the a later chapter will cover the DM side of the gods. But yeah, so this is Gods of Theros. They're basically your Greek gods. There's an explanation of what Greek gods mean, more or less, that kind of leads the introduction if you're not familiar with Greek mythology and sort of how the gods interact with mortals.
And then it talks about how the gods interact with humans and other mortals, and then how they interact with each other. They're usually fighting, which of course is just Greek gods.
Yeah, the thing to keep in mind here is, like, you know, clerics or heroes, champions tend to be devoted to single gods, but most people sort of pray to whatever god is relevant within the pantheon, you know, but they're not really resisting their destiny and they're accepting fate as it is anyway. It does make a note that parties do not have to worship the same god, kind of lets you figure that out for yourself as to why your party came together. And then it notes that champions are chosen by gods, not by mortals, and mortals don't have to consent to that. So you could be a character who was chosen for your valor in combat, but be serving the god of valor in combat against your will.
There are 15 new gods. We don't need to go through all of them because they are your Greek gods. Heliod, god of the sun, not
yep.
Helios. Sure. All right. There's a lot of like homage type names. You know, there's a god of destiny, there's a god of deception. It's basically your Forgotten Realms.
Yeah, there's, you know, your Eros, your god of victory, your Nylea, god of the hunt. Like, also, there's a weird thing where they have called them all god, but then they gender them in the text. So their title is god, but they have gender, and you have to go read to figure out which one is a god and which is a goddess.
Cool, cool.
None of them are non-gendered. Why did they ungender one word and not the actual character? I don't understand.
They didn't do it for space because there's enough room to fit goddess anywhere they needed.
Yeah, yeah. No, it just makes it harder to reference. Half a statement, half inclusion.
Yeah, even something about like, you know, mortal gods don't necessarily adhere to mortal ideas of gender. You know, this could be fluid. Some of them have like very specific gender identities and others don't, but there isn't anything like that.
No.
I mean, Apollo kept turning into like flowers and, you know, Zeus was like, hey, you know what ladies like? Bulls and swans and golden yeah. showers, like literal showers of gold, not the things that you dirty people are thinking of.
Not the thing that Trump likes.
All right, then we get piety, the piety system that has been referenced so many times before it actually shows up in the book.
Uh-huh.
This is just Ravnica's renown system, right? Reskin?
Yeah, they took the DMG renown, they ported it to Ravnica for factions, now they've ported it into Theros for piety. It's the same, you know, benefits at level 3, benefits at level 10, benefits at level 25, benefits at level 50.
You pick a god. This is the one that I'm worshiping that gives you a piety of 1 when you first start your character. And then basically every session, you probably get 1 more piety if you've done something to like advance your god's agenda. But it's basically assumed that you are going to gain 1 piety per session.
It gives you the information you need about the god to pick which one you want to worship. Kind of gives you some information about that. Suggested alignments, classes, and backgrounds for what typical champions might look like. All the, you know, flavor tables, so you can get favor and ideals based on your god, descriptions of how you might earn or lose piety with that god, and then the big list of benefits.
Yeah, I mean, I do like that they sort of call out reasons you might lose piety, but it does feel a little bit like we're sort of inching back toward, you know, pre-fourth edition paladins, where you don't need to worry about like violating your god's edicts. You need to worry about violating the edicts that your GM thinks are your gods.
Right. Right.
So you really need to get on the same page there to make sure that you're not losing piety for doing things that you think are really in character. Oh, and if you change gods, you're just screwed. You started a piety 1.
Yeah, right. Your devotion to another god means nothing to the new god who has wooed you to their side.
Which means there is no reason to switch gods.
Yeah. Like, well, there are, because some of the gods just kind of suck, actually. So who cares about your piety if you're getting lousy abilities? All of them like have the same rough structure. So at 3 piety, you get roughly the equivalent of a first level spell. Not everybody gets that, right? Like, it's not always as simple as just getting a spell, but it's something roughly akin to that. 10, you get roughly a third level spell. 25 is like a weird band. New abilities, you might get advantage on certain checks. You know, might get something that triggers on a short or a long rest. I think some of them give you a spell as well. I don't remember that specifically. But then 50, the capstone, is the reason you're here, right? Like, it's the reason you don't give up your god. You just get to increase 1 of 2 abilities, ability scores, you know, up to, and increase your maximum. So you can go up to 22 or up to 24 if you're an oracle.
Right. This is basically the epic destinies of fourth edition. Like basically all of them gave you +2 to +2 scores. This one is +2 to +1, but you have to choose between two that are offered by the gods. So this is sort of the situation where you have to be like, all right, what class am I playing? What do I want to increase at like level 16 when I hit 50 piety? And plan ahead, which I kind of hate.
Yeah, there's... yes. especially when they don't naturally align, right? Like, like one example, like Nylea, the goddess of the hunt, or the goddess of nature. How could you possibly keep them apart? It's the goddess of the hunt. But like, so barbarian fits, right? Like barbarian is a natural fit for a goddess of the hunt. Mm-hmm. Sure. Except that you can only increase your dex or wisdom score by 2, both of which are secondary characteristics for a barbarian, right? Like, so cool, I'm a barbarian, I'm fitting the theme, but I'm actually kind of getting punished if I stick with this god the whole way. Like, that sucks.
And getting punished for not like looking ahead in the book and planning your character out long before you've actually done anything with the character and know what like the character might choose in game.
Yeah.
Which kind of sucks. I mean, there are other things you need to look at too, like Athreos, the god of passage who sort of like moves people on to the afterlife. Like, one of the ways you can lose piety is by removing wealth from a corpse. That's looting.
Yeah, you can never loot. You have to leave them alive and rob from the living and then kill them.
Right. You have to disarm them of all their valuables and then kill them.
Thieves are cool.
You have to bring them back to life, take their stuff, and then kill them.
Right. So I will say, like, each of these deity entries comes with like their areas of influence and the myths and things related to those gods. Like, the myths are interesting. I mean, they're stuff that's pretty familiar, you know, if you remember any Greek mythology, but like, it is helpful to just have it translated into Theros speak. I guess like it's probably inspirational for kids who haven't gotten to ninth grade English class yet. But otherwise, like, you probably remember this. Or at least remember the rough structure of it.
Yeah, this is one of those situations where, you know, you have myths to draw from, to put in your backstory. But if you do know Greek myth, you can also just at the table be like, what was, I want to do like an Orpheus type thing. Who is, what's the his name here in this setting? And someone else who actually has read this book and just tell you, and you can integrate it. You know, you don't necessarily have to draw from all of these tables.
And then just a weird note, the forge and grave domains are used by Atheros, the god of passage, and Perforos, the god of the forge. But those are not reprinted here. So they're only in Xanathar's guide, which would make them not Adventurers League legal because it wouldn't be PHB +1. So get wrecked, AL players who want to play Perforos or Atheros in Adventurers League.
Maybe if you complain loudly, they'll change something.
Or I don't know. They might not even be running an Adventures League season for this, given the COVID and everything else.
All right, next chapter, the realms of gods and mortals. As you said, Shane, the known world is 200 miles across, which comes with its own issues.
Yeah, so whatever. Ignore that. It's Greece, right? It's Greece, except only the parts you've heard of. So Akros is Sparta. Melitis is Athens. Setessa is the island of the Amazons in Wonder Woman, which bonus points if you remember the name of that. I don't.
Themyscira.
Cool. You get the bonus points. Like, literally, they're Amazons. They kick out the men. It's fine. There is Orescos, which is the grasslands on which the Leonin live. There's Scophos, which is the Minotaur city-state. That is the great rival to Akros. So guess which state that is. And then there is Phoboros, which is a badlands that separates Scophos and Akros. It's the home of Minotaur outcasts and generally bad stuff.
You have the Siren Sea and the Dacra Islands in the middle of the ocean. Nyx, the home of the gods, and then the underworld, which is where everybody goes when they die. So there are some good parts and some not so good parts.
Yeah, you've got your Elysium Fields, and then you've got your your Sisyphean trials, if you will.
Yeah, you got your Tartarus over here. And that's it. That's the whole world.
Yep. So short and sweet, should be easy to keep in your head. Not a lot of room to like pull in other elements from other places, right? Like you might be able to sneak elves into Skophos, or you might be able to fit, you know, orcs into Phoboros. Sorry, I guess you would put elves in Setessa. I can't keep these names apart. You might put your orcs into Skophos or Phoboros, something like that. Or maybe they would live on the grasslands with the Leonin, like whatever. But like, there's not a lot of room, and they're definitely not going to have a lot of cultural history to draw from. They're just going to be kind of following the cultural history of whatever place you pick, and they're going to look different.
Yeah, Theros is definitely a setting where like you should just play it as it's written. I wouldn't recommend too much reskinning because it's tight in terms of the places that you can go and the things that you can do.
Yeah.
Next chapter, creating Theros adventures.
This starts out with a pretty clear disclaimer that Theros is about god-based adventures. If you don't want to play with deities running your life, do not play Theros. Like, the assumption of the setting is you will be serving and interacting and dealing with gods. They will ruin your day from time to time. They will give you quests and burdens that you have to deal with. That's the game.
Yeah, I like that they call this out, and I like that they then give you some advice on like how to handle that in your game.
Right.
So here you get, this is what you were talking about. This is basically the GM explanation of the gods. It goes through all of the gods again, talks about who their champions might be, who they might select, what kind of quests they might send them on, how to structure a campaign, and then what kind of blessings, like actual blessings from the DMG, that they might give their champions.
It also offers 5 frameworks for why an adventuring party might come together in Theros. This, to me, is the biggest stretch of this setting. Like, this is where you see the D&D and the Magic the Gathering really rubbing against each other. So the first one is serving 2 or more masters. And the advice is figure out why you all come together.
Like, why would these 2 gods be working together?
Yeah, I don't know. Figure it out.
Probably a golden apple.
Yeah, there are some good ones, like Divine Coalition, which is the idea that several gods are uniting their champions against some common threat. I think that's pretty straightforward. Or, you know, against another coalition of gods. Friendly cooperation, just generally the gods will trade favors amongst each other. So my champion will help yours today in exchange for your champion helping mine a little bit later. There's Together by Circumstance, which I think is probably the most compelling, which can then kind of evolve into one of the others like over time. But this is like something has happened, like you are on a galley in a storm that is sinking, right? You are in a city that's under attack, you're on the same side of a war, and you're forced to work together. What happens?
Yeah, this is actually pretty decent advice, like this little section, for any game where you've got a pantheon and everybody's sort of picking different gods and you're trying to figure out why, like, you know, Lathander and Ilmater are both interested in this one particular quest at the same time.
Yeah.
Then it includes villains and monsters that you can use for a particular god, and information on how to use a particular god as the villain for your campaign.
This is very important. It's mostly okay advice. Like, I don't want to like, hey, they really nailed this section. But the fact that this section is included at all, right? The idea that any god can be the villain, is important, because that's how the Greek gods are. Like, there's no good ones. They all suck at some point. Some of them suck all the time. Others will just kind of be a hassle, you know, like when it's least convenient for you.
Yeah, I mean, even the good ones don't understand consent.
Yeah, and don't really respect their champions very much either.
Right. We get some mechanical advice here on how to incorporate some character abilities. So it talks about how a god might assist a character. There's some advice about not eliminating character choice, right? The gods will help you out, but they won't necessarily solve your problem. They won't eliminate the risk and the danger. They might tip the scales in your favor or, you know, against you, but they're not going to make sure that something happens.
Right. Doesn't offer an explanation for why that is, but it's very good gameplay advice. So definitely take that to heart. They also provide a list of omens, advice for divinations and dreams and visions, like which I think is just super good advice in general, because those spells mm-hmm. exist outside of Theros, and it's not necessarily like super tied to Theros gods as much as it is just like, here are some ideas for how you can represent all of these augury spells and things like that, in which this should be very close and personal to a lot of your characters. We have an oracle as a super human gift.
I mean, this is info that I would have liked more expanded in the DMG, right? Like, mm-hmm. how do you handle all of these divination spells?
And then it gives you divine ordeals, which are basically like a process by which you request your god test you in exchange for some miracle, some gift, some magic item. First of all, you have to get to Nyx, which it gives you two very specific reasons you can't just do that. Like, I don't know why. Plane shift doesn't work, and gate does work, except usually they don't allow you to do it. So go sail off the side of the map. Apparently, that's how you get here.
Get a boat.
Great.
The ordeal is an interesting construct. It's kind of like a one-on-one encounter, though, or everybody can sort of have their own ordeal, so it sort of splits the party.
Yeah.
I would have liked options where, you know, everybody sort of has one big ordeal and then it's just a regular encounter, you know?
It feels like a good side session idea, more so than like a main everybody at the table involved kind of thing.
Yeah.
But it's an important piece of Greek mythology, so therefore it should be a piece of Theros mythology. So at least they acknowledge that.
And then did you get excited when it said nautical adventures?
Did I?
Were you still excited once you read the section?
I'm look, I've read a lot of nautical adventure advice, so none of this was like none of this was a light bulb going off for me, right? Like, I've read Stormwrack cover to cover from third edition. Like, I read Ghosts of Saltmarsh. Like, I'm now, like, I've read this. Like, I don't think that's super useful for me. I think it's fine, right? Like, it covers some practical concerns. Like, it does a good job of like, giving you an idea of, like, what do you find when you sail into, like, those, like, whatever the islands are called to the south, you know? Like, you find mystical islands. Like, the gods create islands out of nothing. You find places that are impossible to exist. Like, so that sort of stuff, I think it makes sense. In terms of running a full campaign on a boat, not going to be using this as the basis of my pirate campaign.
No, I mean, it's essentially random tables of what would you find on the Odyssey.
Yeah.
You know, because you look through this like, oh, right, I see. People are turned to swine. Yep, that makes sense. And then on Underwater Adventures, the next section is basically, what could you find if you went to Atlantis?
Yeah.
And then Underworld is following, you know, Orpheus and Eurydice or Persephone. All of those stories. What kinds of things might you encounter if you go to the underworld? Although then there is some nice information about like things that can happen if you actually die, because the underworld is a physical place that you can go to. And if you die and then your soul goes there, you actually might be able to leave.
Then there is an adventure called No Silent Secret, pretty short for first level characters.
Speaking of people who come back from the dead, it begins with a person who did come back from the dead, who has now been killed again. And the party is basically tasked with finding out who did it.
It's a short adventure, so it is what it is. But I think the story kind of overview, right? Like the general sweep of the story fits really well.
Right. It pulls in multiple gods. If you're going to start a group in Theros who doesn't really quite grasp how things work here or what the setting is like, just, you know, run them through this and all will be revealed.
Since this is going long and we have no natural break, give us one moment to run an ad in the mid-roll and we will be right back to discuss treasures.
Leave behind the safety of the Humblewood and travel down the Tangrip coast to the Bay of Baloosh, home to both the Kingdom of Den and the Serpent Domain. But neither hold the true power of the Bay, for that lies in the sea itself and the pirate lords that call her tides their home. The dread pirate Captain Bluebeak, Tiberius Fang, Kin the Bladeless, and Gabrielle LaFleur, the self-proclaimed pirate queen. Each one vying for power over the very tides themselves. But do any of them really have what it takes to hold up the legacy of the briny bulldog? Tune in each week to find out if our little crew has what it takes to stand up to the pirates of the blood-soaked waters. Dark Fortunes is available every Monday on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. Set sail for high seas adventure.
All right, so treasures. We've got 8 magic items.
Flying Chariot, Awesome.
Which is cool. Yeah.
Pyxis of Pandemonium. Less awesome.
it's one of those legendary gacha items where it's like, I gave you a legendary. Also, it completely screws you. I mean, it's Pandora's box.
Yeah, it's really good for you when you first touch it and get a free short rest. It's really bad after that.
Yeah, absolutely not worth the short rest.
I did like to see that they had some love paid to slings. There were sling bullets of Altheomony, which are just magic sling bullets that add extra effects and are very limited use. And then there's the two bird sling, which lets you, if you hit a creature, then hit a creature within 10 feet as well, which I thought were very cute because this is, you know, Theros, it's Greek, it's, you know, hoplites and such. So slings are still relevant weapons.
Yeah, and if you're using a sling that you've chosen to use one, you should be rewarded.
Yeah, exactly. You're still using a sling that far? Take your rare sling.
And then we get five artifacts, each tied to a different god, and their abilities, they have regular abilities, and they have additional abilities based on your piety score for that particular god.
Yeah. There's also like advice and adventure hooks for like why you might introduce these into the campaign or how it might. So I like that. I thought these are relatively usable artifacts in that regard. And since it ties into the piety, that's nice. I did notice the Bow of Nylea does not have a bonus if you are piety 50 or above, which all the other ones do. So I don't know if that's a typo or a deliberate choice.
Right, which is disappointing because I was happy to see a magic bow. You just don't get a lot of those.
Yeah, it's also a dope bow. They're all +3 weapons is where it starts. They all do extra damage on a hit, except for the Bow of Nylea, which increases your crit range.
All right, and then chapter 6 is Friends and Foes. We get 46 new stat blocks for creatures to fight. And then a thing called Mythic Monsters, which we'll get to in a sec.
Yeah, so there's also the Nyxborn Monster Modifier. Basically lets you modify any monster by adding magic resistance, or there's a table that you can roll on to add additional abilities. It doesn't give you any advice about how this changes CR, though at this point, CR is so out the window given how many different parameters increase your character's power that, like, I don't know how useful it is.
You should be aiming for, like, deadly challenges anyway because you're characters are already so strong.
Yeah, deadly plus probably.
In terms of the monsters here, there are things you would expect in a Greek monster manual, right? You've got a chimera, you have those archons who were mentioned before, the anvil rots construct people, you know, you get a little golden owl made of metal, which maybe some of you will remember from Clash of the Titans. Harpies, hippocamp, giants, a ram, some lions, oracle, satyrs, the usual creatures.
Yeah.
Oh, and some hydras, more hydras.
Yeah, it's lots of variants of your classic mythological creatures. And then they also give you some advice for just using the classical mythological creatures from the monster manual. So that's kind of what shapes the full bestiary. I think that makes sense. Like, you don't necessarily need to, you know, throw a bunch of like mind flayers into Theros. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense,
right? Or have to do all the trouble of like reskinning them completely to turn them into something vaguely Greek,
right? What we're really here for is the actual advancement in 5e mechanics, which is mythic monsters. So they're all high CR from 17 to 26, all three of them,
right? And you say all.
Yeah, what makes them like function is they have a fight reset condition upon their death. So when they're reduced to zero, they are instead basically restored to full. And then they gain a different like mythic action, like basically a legendary action option or two that opens up after they trigger the mythic.
Right. And those actions are usually like more powerful or do more damage, and you can replace one of your legendary actions with them. So, I mean, it's the Legend of Zelda, like it sheds its skin. It's the Frieza, here's my final form thing.
It's bloodied. It's just bloodied.
Right. And instead of just saying, okay, this thing has 600 hit points, and when it hits half hit points, it undergoes this change, they do the whole like reset thing. So I think when you're eyeing a monster and being like, all right, how much difficult is it going to be? I'll look at the CR. I'm taking a look at its attack bonus and how many hit points does it have. The hit points are they really will throw you off if you don't notice the mythic ability.
Yeah. I mean, and it does say when you use the monster, like, treat the encounter as fighting two CR21 monsters, right? Because you're fighting them sequentially and they're mm-hmm. effectively meant to be solos. So that's going to be the encounter that you're planning is two 21s, not 121 that has a cool ability.
In general, though, I feel like the additional mythic actions don't give it enough variety to avoid your party feeling like they're just fighting the same monster all over again.
Yeah, I mean, like, one of them gets a different victory condition, right? So, like, you stab its hearts that are revealed through its carapace instead of, like, you know, just stabbing it wherever, I guess. There's a one of them, like, it's a Medusa, right? So, like, it gets the ability to force its Medusa gaze upon somebody, which otherwise has to be, like, done as a basically a trick or a mistake, right? So, like, I don't know, like, that feels like it's more high powered, or at least it feels like a different kind of action. But to a player, you already knew that gaze was going to wreck your day. Like, forcing it upon them doesn't actually feel like this is a harder fight. It just feels like I got to do less in this fight.
Right, and I blew most of my, like, big abilities and spells in the first and second round of combat, and now here we are in the fourth. We're still nowhere near done. Like, it, the things that you use for a GM to telegraph in 5e, since you don't have the bloody condition, you say, like, how hurt does it look? Is it bleeding? And if you just look at the HP, yeah, it's bleeding a lot. You know what I mean? It looks like it's about to topple over. Oh, suddenly it completely regenerates.
Yeah, it's... It's a new mechanic. I'll say that.
Yeah.
I think it needs to be used very carefully. I'd be curious to how this plays out for most tables. I suspect at our table it would be met with consternation and a lot of frustrated players.
Yeah, I mean, in general, monsters in 5e don't need more hit points. They need to deal more damage, although less so lately, but combats just need to go faster. Like, it even calls out, this is for a longer combat. Who has ever wanted a longer combat in 5e?
Yeah, this takes your three round combat and turns it into a six round combat against the same monster.
Right, it takes your one session combat and turns it into a two session combat.
Right. Then this is normally where we mention if there is or is not an index. We have no idea because we don't have the printed copy. We're only looking at D&D Beyond, so hopefully they include it. But if they don't, wouldn't be the first time.
No, not at all. A note about the art. A lot of the art in this book is really, really good. I'm pretty sure that's because it's from Magic Cards, and they get much better art than D&D usually does.
They do. There are also a decent number of maps that are included. Each of the gods has, like, an example area where you might have an encounter with them or their minions or whatever. These are mostly fine. I think they're much more useful in D&D Beyond version because you can pull them down and actually, like, use them. They're not so useful. Like, they're complicated maps. They're not so useful to recreate out of a book, like a printed copy, you know? Like, redrawing caverns is not going to get you the effect you're looking for. You need the digital version of this map to get value out of it. So it's great in D&D Beyond. It's probably less useful in other places.
All right, so now's the time where we talk about whether our listeners should buy this book. Shane, is this a buy or a pass?
I don't know. I don't. If it sounds interesting, sure. I don't think this adds a whole lot that it's like, oh, this is the D&D book. It's, you know, what, a month, 6 weeks after Wildemount, like, coming out with a brand new setting. You know, it's just like, it's a lot, and it doesn't add so much to the game that I feel like this one is mandatory because you're on such a slow drip of 5e anyway. I prefer this to Skag, which I said to buy because you have no choice. So,
well, low bar.
How about you, Ishan?
Yeah, this is a pass for me, and I say that as someone who has run a campaign set in ancient Greece. But if I am going to do that again, I will just use actual Greek myth, right? I don't need all of the reskinning.
That's actually the interesting part of this to me, is not running Theros. It's unskinning it back to Greece and
right.
having all the tools you need to run it in Greece and run Hellenistic D&D. That's cool. Actually, that's my buy condition for this, is that. Because having the more monsters, like the bestiary that's already sorted for that, I think that makes sense. I'm back into this.
I mean, like, who doesn't want to play a Xena warrior princess game, right? Like, and actually fighting Ares. like a Disney's Hercules. I would totally do that. Like, let's go beat up Hades. But I mean, this book doesn't really give me what I need. I have actual Greek myth to do that. And in terms of the mechanics, there are some interesting things here. You know, piety's kind of interesting, but I could also get that in Renown, or I could come up with it on my own. Mythic actions, of course, are interesting, but none of those ideas are going to stay in this book. They're going to show up somewhere else. And so I would just wait until I see them there, and they probably will be a bit more refined.
I am lazy enough that I would say it's probably worth the $30, at least for the digital version, to just get all of those like piety paths built for you for the 15 gods that anybody of your players actually knows anyway. They track close enough that, like, yeah, Poseidon works. Like, I can use Thassa as Poseidon. Great.
All right, so there we go.
Sort of by.
I'm a pass, so
okay.
we're 50-50.
It's 50-50 on something.
Hey, okay. If you're gonna buy it, go do it at your local game store.
Yeah, do that. All right, let's talk about how our listeners can get in contact with us.
We do love hearing from you.
You can tweet at Shane at Mundangerous. That's M-U-N dangerous.
And you can tweet at Ishan at Evil Sans Carne. That's malice minus meat.
And you can tweet at the show at TPTcast.
You can also email us at totalpartythrill@gmail.com.
And you can find us on the web at www.totalpartythrill.com.
Or also on Facebook and Instagram at Total Party Thrill.
You can also join the conversation on Discord. There is a link in the show notes. We also want to thank our Patreon supporters.
Yeah, because your support is what makes it possible for us to keep doing this show every single week. So if you'd like to learn more, you can check out all our rewards at patreon.com/totalpartythrill.
You can also leave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It is a great way to support the show for free and help other people find us. If you do that, we will read your review on the air.
Just like this one, 5 stars from Jeff, aka Krieg. Must listen. I started listening 2 years ago and have gone through the entire library. Intelligent and fun.
I think they opened up reviews to mobile, and that has made everything much easier. Huge, huge, huge influence on the length of our 5-star reviews. I love it. All right. What do we have planned for next week's episode?
We are talking about support characters.
And in the Character Creation Forge?
We're building the Accomplice.
Well, that's it for episode 255 of Total Party Thrill. I hope we lived up to our name, but either way, I'm Shane.
And I'm Ishan. Thanks for listening.
Total Party Thrill is brought to you this week by Cobalt Press.
Empire of the Ghouls is an Underdark campaign for levels 1 to 13. The matching Underworld Player's Guide includes new playable races from Darrow to Dark Trollkin to Drow to Mushroom Folk, plus new spells, subclasses, and backgrounds.
And the Underworld Lairs book includes standalone Underdark adventures for characters level 3 to 14.
The whole package is available now from KobaltPress.com or on Roll20 and Fantasy Grounds for online play.
You can find out more at www.cobaltpress.com and tell them DSPN sent you.